This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. If you need any more information, head to FUBARradio.com.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's fan club on FUBAR Radio.
The problem today was I had my headphones backwards.
And now they don't look right now. They do not look right now.
The wires all over the place. Hello, my name's Nick Helm.
And my name is Nathaniel Metcalf.
What's that beeping? It's a fucking truck backing up. All right, let's just all fucking calm down, people.
Come on.
It's Friday. The weekend has started.
The weekend starts here.
The weekend starts
here.
Now.
On FUBAR Radio. Midday.
It's midday. It's just after. Just after midday. Oh, God. We're both very tired. Nat's started a new job. And I've been up all night. Fucking. No, not really. He hasn't got a new job. No, he has.
My mic's been turned down because I laugh too loud.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. One of my favourite things in the world is making other people laugh. And I think it's a sad day when I turn up to work in FUBAR Radio and find that Nathaniel Metcalf, my partner in crime, to find that his microphone settings have been tampered with.
I thought FUBAR Radio was uncensored broadcasting. Fucked up beyond all recognition.
I tell you what is fucked up beyond all recognition. Their policy for laughter volume. So, my name is Nick, and this is...
Nat.
And you're listening to Fan Club.
What is the first rule of Fan Club
is tell your friends about Fan Club. Second rule of Fan Club is
please,
for the love of God, tell your friends about Fan Club. I'm still not going to sink to the depths that other podcasters do and beg people for 5-star reviews on iTunes. Yeah. It's absolutely pathetic. But we have been informed that last week we had a paltry 42 likes. 41 5-star reviews, and then some fucking cunt went out of their way to give us a fucking 4-star review. I mean, what you fucking said earlier, Nat, what you fucking said earlier, right, is absolutely fucking bang on, right? It's fucking, you go online and you either give it a fucking 5 or a none.
Don't give it none.
Right? Right? If you give it none, I mean, it's almost like you weren't there, like you're a ghost, right? Yeah. Because there's no star review policy on iTunes. And if you are giving it a 4-star, I think you've got to listen to at least fucking one show, haven't you? You've got to listen to at least... No, 2 shows, sorry, is what I meant. You've got to listen to at least 2 shows, haven't you? Because you've got to compare them, because it might not be me and Nat's fault. It might be our guest.
It might be their fault.
It might just be the fact
them.
That we had an awful guest that was just sort of like filling up your ears with nonsense, you know? Don't blame us, because, you know, our booking people fucked up. I mean, like, what's it? TripAdvisor you're talking about? There's a new website out, and I'm going to look it up as we finish. Called TripAdvisor.com.
I think.
It's called TripAdvisor.com, and you can give a 0-star review. I mean, and I can absolutely understand that. If you've had an awful time on,
holidays and that.
Wow, if you've had an awful... I've got to look into this. If you've had an awful time on holiday, then absolutely, steer people well away. But if you've had a great time, let them know. But no one wants to know about your fucking...
4-star holiday.
Your fucking 3-star trip to fucking Alton. Towers, you know, fuck, you know, stop wasting our time. Anyway, 67 5-star reviews.
67 5-stars.
But,
well, I guess that even now there's more 5-stars, that even goes to show the 4-star one. It makes it seem even more foolish.
Even more foolish and petty.
Petty.
Do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to switch on my dial up. And I'm going to open up my laptop, and I'm going to put in my my password, and, you know, and then I'm going to fire up Google, and then I'm going to go into my iTunes, and then I'm going to Yeah, I'm going to get this off my chest. Yeah. Not quite five.
Yeah. What else Drakeney has on his iTunes? Tom Petty.
Yes. Because he's petty.
Petty.
And Billy Idol, because a bit of a fan. Didn't quite understand where we were going. But I wanted to chip in. So good. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Still not enough. Brett Goldstein, as I say, has got something like 500 five-star reviews. And it's a fine show. But but he doesn't do it live. He does a lot of editing. And we do 2 hours a week now. So come on.
It's twice as long.
Come on. It's twice as long.
Twice the fun.
Tell your friends, hashtag. Tell your friends, hashtag. Tell your friends, hashtag. I've been doing my show this week.
You have been?
I think you stink at the Pleasance. First time in... it's 10 years. I did it in Edinburgh 10 years ago, and then it's the first time I've done it since 2008. I did it 2010. So I did it in a pub in 2010. So I haven't done it in 8 years. We did it last night. Went very well. But I'm fucking exhausted because it's a lot of work. And my agent came up to me yesterday and she goes, oh, it does look like a lot of work. And it's just like, that's not like the greatest compliment that you're going to get.
But you've done it again.
Darling, you've done it again. I think
that's fan club.
Wow, just wow! I can't believe you did that. that was a Laurence Olivier thing, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah.
Did we talk about that last week?
Yeah, I think it's last week, was it?
Yeah. she came over to go to play. It did look like a lot of work. You go, yeah. But I always think My USP is my unique selling point. Mm-hmm. Is that a lot of comedians try and make it look easy, but I want people to know exactly how hard I find it. So people come out of my shows feeling more exhausted than I do. They go, "Fucking hell, that looked like a lot of hard work." And you go, "Yeah, I know it is hard.
It does. I think it's really hard. Stressful.
It's stressful. I want to sweat on them, and I want them to be like, oh, God, that's disgusting.' Yeah, it is disgusting, isn't it? The depths that I've had to sink to in order to make a living, an honest living. It's not an honest living. We're all liars. I haven't watched it. I did one thing this week to talk about. I did it last Saturday, and we record on. This is a Friday show, so basically now it's Friday again. I haven't done anything since last Saturday. We rehearsed all weekend, and then I forgot that I had tickets to see ELO.
Oh yeah,
And I went with my friend from university, Ollie McCormack. Hello, Ollie. He's not listening. I mean, I've told my friends.
They don't listen.
It just falls on
deaf ears.
No, not deaf ears, but ears that work perfectly well.
Oh, unbelievable!
They've just refused to open their hearts to this kind of like, I don't know what this is. It's a roller coaster of emotions. I do enjoy this show. I think I'm going to give it. I might have given it five stars. I think I might have.
I hope you didn't give it four, and it was you just.
I tell you what is four. ELO, bloody hell! Yeah. I went on TripAdvisor. I went on to TripAdvisor. No, but I went on .co.uk /org. -EU gov.co.uk.org I went to ELO. It's brilliant. I was sort of like so we rehearsed at the Pleasance here basically, and then I remembered about late in the day, like 6 o'clock, that I had to go to ELO at Greenwich in the O2 arena. I was just thinking, ELO, Jeff Lynne's ELO, mm-hmm. at the O2 Arena. Bloody hell.
Is there another operating ELO without Jeff Lynne?
No, but I imagine, and I don't think so, but I don't know that much about ELO. All I know is that he's very much the Claudio
Simonetti
of ELO. So Jeff Lynne's ELO is, I guess that the rest of ELO don't do it anymore, and it's just him doing his songs.
I wonder what I'm always fascinated by those stories, though, and how those bands, whether they're all like each other or whether there's some sort of shady business going on.
I think probably they just didn't want to do the same songs. Well, I don't know. He just came across as really kind of like down to earth and normal. He looks like Chas Hodges.
Yeah, he does. And he's just like, he's sort of from the Midlands somewhere, isn't he?
Yeah. He's just like, all right.
All right, ducks, I've got some ELO songs coming up for you, hours. Is it like that?
Yeah, it was. Great. He was like, wow, it's a massive turnout. I've got to thank you all for being here. Anyway, there's Mr. Blue Sky. Ding, 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 ding. It was really. But anyway, so I was on my way to Greenwich. I was thinking, oh God, this is fucking ball eight going all the way to Greenwich on this.
It's normally night. You like to work at Fubar, which is just around the corner from your house.
I like to work around. Do you know what? I had a policy. I've got a friend that was at the show last night, and he said, "Oh, we've got to meet up for some sort of Christmas dinner, like before in December. We're having this thing," and I said, "Yeah, but only if it's in London." Because I'm not travelling, I've made that mistake before. Travelled out of London, ended up in some guest room. Mm. No thanks.
Brexit means Brexit, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a hard Brexit.
It is.
And there's no deal.
No deal.
What were we thinking? So anyway, it's Lefty! Lefty's on the radio! Fucking, it just makes sense, doesn't it, not to fucking leave and fucking cut our own dicks off to spite our cunts. So, so anyway, ELO, try not to let it bother you, but what can we do? We're drowning. So ELO.
ELO.
That's how he opened. ELO.
Did he?
No.
Oh.
No, he didn't. But I was on my way down to, this isn't even a story.
That's good, this is what we do.
I was on my way down to fucking see ELO, Jeff Lynne's ELO, and I went down and I was like, what's this going to fucking be? And I just assumed that it's the sort of thing that you could do on a keyboard in the back room of a pub.
Yeah.
Right? And then I remembered they're called the Electric Light Orchestra.
They are too.
And the fucking, I've never seen it more rammed. The O2 Arena was absolutely fucking rammed and just full of ELO fans. And
who'd have thought it?
And do you know, what does an ELO fan look like?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Very much like you or I.
Okay.
Only, obviously, older. But ELO fans, yeah, and it was absolutely rammed. We were right at the back, like right at the top of the arena at the side, but right at the back. Yeah. Our backs were against the wall, right at the back.
Oh, okay.
And I was just like, these are amazing seats. We can see everyone. And I really did enjoy it. Now, they had lasers.
Electric lights, in other words.
Electric lights, but they had lasers, and there was a fucking orchestra. There was like a 30, no, probably not 30, but like a 20-piece orchestra that was on stage. And the light show was incredible, and he had like a screen on the floor that he was standing on that would kind of show different things, different carpets from tonight. Be standing on. Oh, it's brilliant.
I've got to be stood on some tellies. Did he say that when he's turning? I've got to be stood on some tellies, doing some songs from the ELO.
It was really good. And then, nothing really prepared me for how fucking batshit mental everyone would go for Mr. Blue Sky.
Right.
And I sort of think that that's one of those songs that is overplayed.
Right.
They'll use it in
some ads and things.
They'll use it in adverts and trailers, and I think they use it a lot in films. Mm. And you go, yeah, it's kind of like the say what you see kind of attitude to using music. It's like the opening opening 45 minutes of Suicide Squad, where it's just like, we use that song. Oh, it's the devil. We'll play Sympathy for the Devil. Mm. And you go, right, So I think it's really overplayed. And I really like ELO, but my favourite is Bring Me Down. I think that is a fucking wicked. That's a banging tune, right? And, Mr. Blue Sky came on, and literally, we were right at the back, and the O2 Arena is really, really, really steep. Mm-hmm. And like to the point where you get vertigo because you stand up and you just think that you're going to fall, and if you fell, you would basically just like slide over everyone's heads and plummet to your death. And I'm surprised that more of that hasn't happened. Yeah, I don't know if any of it's happened. Can we look that up to see if anyone's
died at the O2?
Well, I mean, we've all died at the O2. I haven't ever died at the O2. Not even for a charity gig. Unbelievable. So, you do those for free.
Your ambition is to die at the O2.
Well, I mean, I've died at the Apollo. So why not up my game? What I've got to say about the Apollo, I did the Apollo, you know, my, what's she writing?
I mean, that's depressing. That's too depressing.
Well, we're not going to, yeah. This is a 3-star on TripAdvisor. so we were the next week. Oh, it doesn't matter. You can't just read the screen while we're talking. Otherwise, it's just me talking into the void.
That's what Fingy does. That's what Jeff Lane does. I'm just reading my screen under my face, watching my little tillies before I do one of my ELO songs.
I did a charity gig at the Apollo the week after I did Live at the Apollo.
Oh yeah,
smashed it. Absolutely smashed it.
Was it on film?
No. did it to save the Asiatic lions.
But it looked good on telly, didn't it?
I looked amazing on telly. Best performance I've ever done. Looks like I'm absolutely enjoying it.
Oh my God. Stop doing
Jeff Linfeld.
Stop putting things
music
up.
Is in Jeff's blood.
That's better. Read that bit.
His father was a great lover of classical music. Don't move it while I'm reading it, Natalie. And could play classical tunes with one finger.
Was it like that?
One finger stuck up at the man.
People can't see that, can they?
Yeah. Oh, right, the webcam. Yeah. If you want to watch this show live, by all means.
Jeff Lynn thinks the Beatles song Love Me Do is especially horrible. Is that Jeff Lynn? That seems weird. He loves them, doesn't he?
He loves the Beatles. Didn't he produce Free as a Bird?
Yeah, I think he did. And those Beatles anthologies, I think, are all Jeff Lynne.
Anyway, Mr. Blue Sky comes on and fucking everyone, like everyone, and none of them can dance.
Do they do this?
Yeah.
With their arms?
they do like hands on hips, yeah. Kind of hip wiggle.
Hip wiggle, yeah.
And Mr. Blue Sky comes on and it's like they've all taken ecstasy and they're at a rave and you've got everyone, they've all got white hair and they're like banging, they're head banging, right? And it was like fucking, and I had never seen anything like it. People were just went fucking nuts for it. And I was at the back going, bit overplayed, and then you realise that you're the cunt in the room. If you're at the O2 Arena and you haven't spotted a cunt yet, it's you. It was good anyway. So I highly recommend. But he sold out like 3 or 4 nights in a row there.
I can see that, right? But probably on the basis of that song. But anyone plays the O2 now, don't they?
Yeah, like but it seems four like nights, everyone does. Like 4 nights. Not like I've seen the O2. No, not the O2. Maybe, but Wembley, where they brought the curtain in to sort of like halve it
off.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
But fucking, I've not seen anything there that was as ramped as that. It was crazy. ELO is not one of those bands that people talk about.
No, you're right.
And then it turns out that everyone likes ELO a little bit. And that's all you need, isn't it?
I think I wasn't even really aware of ELO growing up, you know? It all feels like ELO have emerged in the last sort of decade or so. Like, I just wasn't really familiar with those songs or anything.
I've got a couple of ELO albums, or maybe I've got a double album, which is a greatest hits, I don't know. But, I listen to it on vinyl.
Well, I wish him good luck.
Yeah, well, good for him. I mean, it's crazy how much he looks like Chas Hodges. I tell you, he's a big. He's a big ELO fan.
Chas
David Trent.
Is he?
He fucking loves him, and he's. But David Trent's got weird kind of music taste because he's really into like Slayer, and then all of a sudden he'll go, "Yeah, but my favourite is Dexy's Midnight Runners." Yeah, really? And he goes, "Yeah." And you're like, come on, Eileen. He goes, no, that's too mainstream. But if you listen to their early stuff, oh, And you go, oh, right. So I learned quite a lot about music driving up and down the country with Trent. Really into it. You know, but like, it's crazy how similar some of his stuff is to Beatles harmonies.
Right.
Where it's kind of like, he obviously loves it. It's weird that he doesn't like, what Love Me Do?
He's got quite odd hair, isn't he? Does he still have that sort of permed hair?
If you want to know what Jeff Lynne looks like,
Google it.
Google Chas Hodges, and it's that. He looks exactly like him.
Well, Chas Hodges died, didn't he, recently? So he could probably be a good replacement.
Well, you just think, yeah, Dave absolutely. Swap like for like, isn't it? No, he's irreplaceable.
Sure, I like Chas Hodges. I like Chas and Dave.
I think everyone likes Chas and Dave.
Sure, I think they're hard not to, and he seemed like a very charming fella. Apparently, when they filmed, there's a Chas and Dave thing they show often at Christmas, which is Chas and Dave's Christmas Knees Up. I think there's also a corresponding album, and they show it at Christmas often with on Channel 5, and it's on every year, and it's filmed in like a sort of old East End pub, but it's not; it's all a set, and so all the studio audience all just sat on these tables as if they're watching the band playing in the pub. When they made it, apparently, it is all just a set, but they had things like the ladies and gents. But because of the audience that came in, they were giving them real booze. So apparently what would happen is the guys would like walk up while they're filming, go to the toilets, realise they're just still in part of the studio, and then just piss all over the floor. And that was Chas and Dave's audience.
Christmas Knees Up.
Christmas Knees Up. There's just people, like, all the guys that work on it, all the crew are just like, oh, no. So everyone's just boozing because it's a Christmas Knees Up. Why wouldn't you be?
Yeah.
Sitting along with Chas and Dave, having a nice time. But they're all just getting up and just going, I've drunk too much now. It probably filmed for hours and hours.
Yeah.
So there's probably just absolutely awash with piss on the floor.
I've never seen it. I'd love to. It'll be on this year.
No doubt.
We filmed the Reluctant Landlord, Romesh's sitcom that's coming out next week.
It starts
on Tuesday, does it? I think the 30th. And that was obviously in a pub. It's filmed in a pub. But it was a set in Shepperton. And you get to there, and in the middle of this huge sort of like, it's like a warehouse, and in the middle of this huge warehouse they've built this pub set, and you're in the pub, and it looks exactly like a pub, down to every single detail. And
is it a studio sitcom or is it a filmed one without an audience?
It is a single camera sitcom, which means it's not like multi-camera is something like Mrs. Brown's Boys, where you film it live
in front of a live studio audience
with multiple cameras, and a single camera is when it's something like Uncle, where it's you use one camera, but you don't. Sometimes you use two. but if you use two cameras, you've got to hire another camera crew.
Oh dear.
So it's double the cost.
Okay.
So which is why sometimes you have so mainly it's single cameras. I know that Uncle was really low budget. So on the first series we could only afford like two cameras like every so often. And it was a real treat those days because you'd get stuff done faster. There's one episode in the first series where all the girls come round all the girls are in my flat, and I think there was like what, six girls, or there was what, Daisy?
Live counting?
I think there was like six characters, or maybe seven, and you've got to do the entire scene take after take. If it's a wide, and also the dinner scene in the third series when I'm on mushrooms, so I think there was like fucking 10 people around that table, and so you've got to film it in a wide, so you've got everyone in there, but you've got to do it because there's 10 people and you're around a table, or we were stood in a circle in the first series.
You've got to do it from everyone's angle
so that you've got everyone in. And then you do.
It's just so I've got some options when I'm in the editing room.
And then you do two shots where you've got two people in the shot or three people in the shot, and they're sort of like mid level shots. And then that you've got to do that, And then you've got to do single shots of everyone. And it takes, you've got to do the entire scene from everyone's point of view. And fucking hell, I think the scene with the girls, I think that took something like 9 hours to film. And it's like a minute long, 2 minutes long. And it took 9 hours. It was absolutely, and I was allergic to the carpet in there because the, I mean, the house that we filmed in the first series was absolutely disgusting. They'd owned a lot of cats and they didn't have, and they hadn't cleaned it. And I'm allergic to cats.
Listening, thanks very much.
Well, I don't know what the story behind it was, but it was weird. And the crew would walk in and out. And so you've got like 30 people churning up the carpets by just walking in it. And then the whole atmosphere was filled with cat hair from like decades. And yeah, and so I was allergic to the thing. And I could, you know, I had to, whenever we filmed in my living room, I had to kind of go in short bursts. And then I'd have to come out again because my face would sort of like react to it.
Hey, hey.
And I couldn't breathe. I was wheezing when in the house and stuff. It was, yeah, there's loads of horror stories about that house. But I don't know who owns it.
Dead cat ghosts?
No, mate. It was absolutely disgusting. Like, the art department showed me photos of what it was like before they put it up. They found the bed, right? The bed in the bedroom of the thing. You know when you do snow angels?
Yes.
Yeah. So the bed, the mattress of the bed had like a brown snow angel all over it. Like it was, but like from years and years of dirt and sweat. And I don't know. I don't know.
Was it like? It's like one Norman of Norman Bates's mum's room.
It was fucking. You know, I think they've obviously replaced the mattress and stuff. But it's like they. I was so impressed with the... I mean, my favourite department generally is the art department. Because you go in and then you get to sort of like look at all of the... I used to do A-level art. Mm. So you go in and you used to... And I always sort of like miss the fact that my... you know, when I do shows, like... I haven't done a play in 10 years. So coming back to doing I Think You Stink, you kind of like you realise, oh yeah, I used to like make all the props and my parents were around on Wednesday night and my mum was sewing... costumes and my dad was painting umbrellas and stuff, and it's kind of like you know, it's like a family business, but really made me miss it. But the art department is always my favourite department, and you go in and you kind of like hang out with them, and they did a really amazing job with the pub on The Reluctant Landlord, and they did a really amazing job with all of my flats and all of the stuff that you have in Uncle. I think I have three different flats in one each series. But the first one, yeah, they took loads of photos of it. It was just an absolute horror show.
Is that because your character is meant to be, like, he's meant to be quite scruffy and quite...
No, because they did it up.
Right. So they had to do it up to make it look like someone who was really scruffy lived there.
I don't think it does look that scruffy. I think it looks really nice. But what they do is they put, like, it looks... I look like a slob, but I look like a slob with taste.
Right.
Because all of the walls are done, you know, it's not like I've fucked up the painting of the walls and the hanging.
Left a brown snow angel in your bed.
I mean, fucking, it wasn't so much brown, it's like black, like dirt. It was like, if Charlotte,
it sounds horrible.
If Charlotte's still got the photos, I mean, fuck, no, it sounds horrible. It's literally one of the most haunting things I've ever seen in my entire life. It's
fucking, Halloween this week, so that's a good...
Yeah, sure, but fucking hell. I mean, it was in such a fucking state, that place. But I tell you what, I won't. I'm probably not allowed to talk about that. I don't know. I think the first series was long enough ago. There was something that happened in the second series. Anyway.
Okay.
We haven't talked about what you've been up to.
What have I been up to?
We had a pub. It was a pub set.
Oh, yeah.
And we'd have toilets that said men's and women's. And, you know. You'd have extras that were like going, I'm just going, can I go to the toilet? And they'd go, but it would be like, it doesn't go anywhere. There's no...
And were they pissing on the floor? Like
they were pissing all over the floor. Pissed all over the floor. And it was fine.
I'll tell you what I've been a fan of this week. The mugs that have been sent in for us, I wanted to mention.
Oh, yeah, we've got some mugs. We've got some fan mugs.
That's been sent in by, well, it's either Sandra or Sandy. that we know from a Twitter name who has revealed that she sent us some mugs, and they're mugs that we've got, like, because we've mentioned on the show before that we haven't got our own FUBAR mugs.
We haven't got our own FUBAR mugs. We don't mention it a lot.
We don't.
But it has been brought up, and I think for the keen listeners,
the fan club fans,
the actual fans of fan club, as opposed to the people that
give us four stars or something.
Casuals.
Tom Petty. that we've been given mugs. These are, well, I guess technically they're unofficial FUBAR mugs because they've been made by someone's fair hands rather than by the official FUBAR things. But they're essentially our proper mugs. And I've got my name on a mug now. There's Nat writ large across it, Nat Fan Club.
Yeah.
Tell your friends, the FUBAR logo, which is almost, we didn't need the FUBAR logo because we've got our own mugs now.
And also I think they're better than the official FUBAR mugs.
Yeah, I think
the names
better.
Are a lot smaller. And I think I'm very grateful for these mugs, and I think that, I don't know, it must have taken quite a while to sort of organise all this stuff.
Must have taken
a couple of days to actually organise all of that stuff
and find the logos and send it to the people that make the mugs.
But 2 days, you know, it's 2 days is a lot faster than fucking 6 months, isn't it? 6 months of being.
Well, it's 6 months plus, Nick, because we still haven't. I mean, it's not like they're here today.
We're doing 2 hours now for the same cost as 1 hour. Mm. And what, we're still on probation? Fucking hell.
I think last week I had a mug that said guest written on it. Guest. Sometimes I have a Sean Walsh's mug. Famous Sean Walsh, double N, from the papers. He's sometimes on my mug. Never have one that says Nat. I've got one now that says Nat.
What have you had in that today?
I had a tea. They're actually quite nice today because they've got some ginger nut biscuits as well. I've had a dip of them.
Do you know what I'm a fan of?
What are you a fan of?
Ginger nut biscuits.
I can't, sorry.
Fucking hell, they're good, aren't they?
They are good.
They're my favourite biscuit. I could eat in my days. I mean, I've got biscuit addiction.
Well, the bad thing is, Nick, which makes it worse, is that I'd say they're not my favourite biscuit, but you can't have biscuits till 4 o'clock, can you?
No, that's true, but I'm not remotely tempted.
Oh, good.
I'm not like, oh, I need a biscuit. I'm just like, no, I can talk about the fact that I like ginger nut biscuits without needing to eat a ginger nut. Mm. I tell you what I don't like. Fucking Jaffa Cakes.
We'll be right back.
Nick and Nat's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back. So what have you been up to this week?
Do you know what? I'll tell you, I've seen a couple of films. I saw the film The Commuter with Liam Neeson. And I had no expectations of it. And I really enjoyed it. And yeah. I didn't think I would at all. It feels like a proper modern age thriller with things like lots of mobile phone. That's normally where things fall down, don't they, plot-wise now? Where you just call these people, wouldn't you, and you say, this is what's happening.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of it was over the top and things, but it sort of used that quite well and had that sort of, it felt like, sure. And I couldn't really pick holes in it.
Yeah. And I like Liam Neeson.
Yeah, I think I like him more than I thought I did. I think of him as quite a sort of silly. I think that sort of his sort of post Taken career almost makes me think of him as being quite a sort of funny, you know, sort of quite a silly actor. And he sort of just does his voice, doesn't he? And he seems like he's created this sort of character.
If you look at his career, then really Schindler's List is a blip on it.
Sure.
It's not like he's like, oh, Mr. Serious. Before that, he made High Spirits, and then he made Darkman.
Yeah.
And they're fucking silly films. And after Darkman, he made Schindler's List, and then he went on to sort of like do. Taken, and then The A Team, and The Voice of Aslan.
But it seems now he does seem to be taking on a lot of work, doesn't he?
I think his career picked up. Mm. I think that's it. I mean, right in the early days, he hadn't done a lot.
I think post Schindler's List, it did feel like he was entering that realm as being like a sort of very serious actor in movie. And I remember when he was announced for Phantom Menace being like, oh my God, they've got Liam Neeson in a Star Wars film. And thinking that seemed like a really big deal. Like, oh wow, I'm surprised he'd do that. And I remember thinking of him then as a much more kind of serious actor.
No, I don't think he's. I don't think he is. I don't think he's ever been. I think that it was. But Schindler's List is probably his most famous thing, wouldn't you say?
Hmm.
But yeah,
now Taken. I think now.
But I really do fucking love Darkman. That's one of my favourites.
Yeah, it's funny.
And it's weird. I was thinking about this the other day because I was thinking about who like my favourite director was, and it's not Sam Raimi, but I did. But I do love, he's made some of my favourite films, but he's so inconsistent. And I don't really like, I mean, I think probably Spider-Man 2 is the best out of the three, but I don't really love the Spider-Man films. And A Simple Plan was good.
Great movie.
But I haven't watched it over and over again. And if I was going to watch a Snowbound thriller, it would be Fargo. what's the other one that he made? With Keanu Reeves in The Gift.
Oh, The Gift, yeah.
That wasn't very good. But Evil Dead trilogy, Army of Darkness is the UK cut. The UK cut of Army of Darkness is my favourite film. But then the director's cut, I think, is almost unwatchable. Darkman, it's one of those films where you just go, it's so silly and inventive and great.
But it's a superhero movie as well, isn't it? Before, that's another one that's essentially like a superhero movie.
Well, they got Danny Elfman in as well to do the music, so it was kind of like post-Batman. It was before, I think it was 1990, so it was before Army of Darkness. And it's really annoying because they wanted Bruce Campbell. Oh, have you ever seen Crime Wave?
Yes, yeah, I have. That's a great movie.
Crime Wave is good and it's awful.
Is it set in Hudsucker? Is it one of those?
Yeah, so the Coen brothers wrote Crime Wave with Sam Raimi, and then Sam Raimi wrote the Hudsucker Proxy with the Coen brothers.
Right, that's right. Yeah.
And Sam Raimi's got a cameo in Hudsucker Proxy, and Bruce Campbell's in it, and Joel Coen did the sound editing. I think it was the sound editing of Evil Dead. So it's kind of like they're all the same gang, and Bruce Campbell gets cameos in Coen Brothers films, but he's always, I think he's sort of a bit of a curse for him, because he was in, Bruce Campbell was in Hudsucker Proxy, which was their biggest flop,
yeah,
and the best film,
Yeah, I love it.
I think it's absolutely their best film. It's one
Raising Arizona is my favourite, but I do love Hudsucker Proxy.
I really like Raising Arizona. But if you watch Raising Arizona, that's so influenced by Sam Raimi. They do they use the same exact shots as well. They put like a camera on a motorbike and they're kind of
yeah, very much so. Yeah,
I love it. Nicolas Cage is great in it. Holly Hunter's great in it. John Goodman. Really. I do love Raising Arizona, but early Coen brothers, you know. Pre Lady Killers. But then Lady Killers, Bruce Campbell's in Lady Killers, terrible film. Bruce Campbell's in Intolerable Cruelty, terrible film. Bruce Campbell is in, they take an old soap opera that Bruce Campbell was in and play that in Fargo as kind of like a little joke.
Oh, actually footage from the.
He was in a soap opera when William H. Macy's wife has got a bag over her head and they stick her in front of the TV and I think the TV's like fuzzy and it's coming in and out. It's Bruce Campbell on the TV.
Oh.
And that's from an old... But that doesn't count because it's not an actual cameo. He didn't turn up. They just used him. And so maybe when he's... But Bruce Campbell... fucking hell. Hudsucker Proxy is such a good... I couldn't believe... You know, Bruce Campbell's in a film with Paul Newman.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
I was really excited about The Lady Killers before it came out. I couldn't see how it could be a bad film.
Yeah.
I thought everything about it. I love the original Lady Killers. That's one of my favourite movies. And I thought doing it with Tom Hanks in the sort of Deep South was like perfect. What an absolutely kind of tacked on perfect idea for a film.
Yeah.
And when you watch it, it's just not, it's not even that. It's just you watching it going, I don't know how this doesn't work.
Yeah. The thing about The Lady Killers was that Barry Sonnenfeld was going to direct it. And the Coen brothers' mum died around that time.
The Coen mother.
Yeah. And they needed a job. They wanted to work, basically.
Right.
And I think, did they write the script or did someone else write the script?
I thought they wrote the script.
I think they wrote the script for Barry Sonnenfeld. And then Barry Sonnenfeld sort of like gave it back to them because they wanted to do a job first. And so they just whacked that out and then they whacked out Intolerable Cruelty. And I think that must have been a script that they had in development. Because they always got like several scripts in development and then they'll finish a script and put it in a drawer and then they'll start another script and then put that in a drawer and they'll start another script and put that in a drawer and then they'll go back to the first script and rewrite that. And then... So they basically did it for work. So I'm sympathetic towards why The Lady Killers is such a shit film, but it is a shit film.
Mm.
Why are we talking about that? Sam Raimi, Liam Neeson.
Yes, where we get to
the commuter. That's Fan Club. So you were talking about the commuter.
Oh, yeah. No, I was just saying it sort of surprised me. I wasn't expecting anything from it. It's obviously all set in the UK. Cause it's got lots of... Or filmed in the UK, sorry, because it's got lots of British actors playing Americans in it.
Right.
But I just thoroughly enjoyed it. It was like, and it really took me by surprise. I'd recommend it to people.
Yeah. My parents get those, like, cardboard... do you know what I mean?
Free
DVDs that you get in the newspaper and stuff. My dad works at Oxfam Books and... And I guess people donate them.
Yeah.
It's just like you can't sell a free DVD off the mirror. So they basically end up with a bunch of them. They've got a sheet in Brittany. And so it's like a holiday home. And they have like a box of these cardboard DVDs out there. And there's always sort of like Liam Neeson straight to DVD ones. I can't remember which one I watched. I watched one where he was in some sort of accident and then he got plastic surgery and then he woke up to be like Liam Neeson and he couldn't work anything out. And it was like this.
It's like a reverse Darkman.
It was rubbish. And that was a hard, but it was like, I'd give it a go because it was Liam Neeson. I like him now.
He's grown on me. He's got a nice thing about him. I think I should give him another go.
But he's not my favourite, do you know what I mean? But he's almost like, I wouldn't say he's like Denzel Washington, but like I would sit down and watch Denzel Washington no matter what because I just think he's solid. And he's really great, but I think Denzel Washington is probably a little bit of a higher calibre than Liam Neeson. But I would watch any old shit that Liam Neeson was in.
I guess Liam Neeson must have started as a very, probably proper... Maybe RSC actor or something?
I don't think so.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't
he's
know
done
background.
Mainly, I mean, I don't
yeah,
know
right.
his opinion. He's done mainly schlock. Action film. Everyone's like, oh, bloody hell, Liam Neeson started. Get out of 1993. It's not. He's not doing Schindler's List anymore. He did it once. Everything else and his thing. Isn't he in something like that? Isn't he in The Long Good Friday or something? He's in one of those
he's
films.
He's not in Long Good Friday.
He's in one of those films from like the early 80s. And but mainly what he's done is kind of B-movies and action stuff. So...
All right,
we've got a guest now.
We've got it's sort of almost like a new feature of sorts, and we thought we'd have a phone guest on, but we thought we'd have a phone guest who was themselves a fan of something.
So we're going to have a go. I'm going to do it by myself today. I'm going to whack up the volume on our guest's telephone, and hopefully he won't sound like a robot because normally we have problems. So if that is the case, Natalie, I want you to back us up and I want you to jump straight in and help us with this. Okay, so on the phone we have James Hyman, the world's largest collection, who's got the world's largest collection of magazines. Hello, James, are you there?
I'm here. How are you doing?
Oh, hello.
It worked.
I did it. This is the first time I've been able to handle the controls myself, James.
How are you, James?
I might have a bit of echo. Hold on, there was a little bit of echo. I can hear myself.
Oh, you can hear yourself.
Oh, yeah. Echoing back.
Oh, is that because have you got the radio on?
Nope.
Oh, well.
You might have a little.
Please come in. Have we got a thing?
I don't know. Oh, God. I mean, this isn't radio.
It is technically radio.
Hello, James. Can you hear yourself now?
Can I hear myself now? Natalie, she's done a good job now.
No, she's done a great job. Right. Brilliant.
Well done. Okay. Thank you.
So you have the world's largest collection of magazines. Is that correct?
I do indeed. I do. Oh, hold on. I think I'm hearing myself again. Or maybe I'm hearing voices. No, it's all good. All good. Let's crack on. No. I do. That is one of the things that I have achieved, the world's largest collection of magazines in the Guinness Book of Records from August 2012. Yeah, it's always been a kind of thing in my life, collecting magazines, pop culture stuff. So, you know, films, music, fashion, technology, sport. It was always a thread in everything I did. I worked at MTV for about 12 years. The first job there was being a script writer. So I had to fill airtime, you know, before internet, before podcasts, before this amazing technology took over all of us. You had to be a bit old school, and I had to fill airtime of presenters talking about things, saying, coming up now is a new video by George Michael or Madonna, and where would you get the information from? Of course, it was magazines.
Right.
Yeah, so I just collected this stuff and used it in a lot of other TV production and presenting stuff I did. And, you know, it hit a point where it turned into an obsession. It still is an obsession. It got into the Guinness Book of Records, and the plan is really to digitize it and make it accessible to the world. So you got like a Spotify for magazines. That would be, for me, I'm sure, millions of others, it would be a phenomenal resource.
How many magazines have you got?
So a current tally, stop counting because it's just too difficult because we're getting donations nearly every day from kind people, probably about 150,000 magazines at the moment.
Where do you keep them?
In a lovely warehouse in Woolwich.
Shout out
to the Stockroom. Big shout out to the Stockroom. They're an amazing crew down there, and it's a lovely place. It's actually a kind of the final resting place for magazines, I'd say, but also lots of media stored there, so films, TV, adverts. It's in good hands with all the other media that is stored there.
How many people work there with you, trying to keep track of them all?
So there's more shout-outs.
How do you categorise them, yeah?
Basically, what we've done is, again, digitising will make this amazing because it'll make it far easier to access. But what we did was a basic inventory, so literally name of magazine, brief description of the magazine, how many issues of that magazine I've got, when the mag started, has the mag defunct, does the British Library have it, does it have a website, just some basic sort of inventory of what I have. It's not like page 64 has got Kylie Minogue advert, blah, blah, blah. That will come from the digitization.
And so when you say the British Library don't have them, because they keep a copy of every book published,
don't they? Well, they do. But however, we did a little... you know, when we were doing this whole thing, and shout out again to Tori and Alexia, Sophie, who's been everyone actually supported this, but Tori and Alexia on a day-to-day basis. What we did, we checked with what the British Library had, because you can see online what the British Library have, and 55% of our titles the British Library didn't have. And that's probably the reason for that is things like very rare, and you can imagine, like, let's say, crazy punk zines that came out, that, you know, people who made those probably didn't think that literally it's a law. I think when you publish something, you are supposed to give a copy to the British Library.
Yeah, I think it's so a lot of it's this got stuff, an ISBN number.
Correct, correct. I think even without ISBNs as well, I think just literally you should donate a copy to them. And a lot of people probably didn't think of, you know, they had to do this or bothered doing it.
Because your books will start, your ISBN number will start with a 978 number, whereas I think a magazine or periodical often starts with 977. Is that right?
Oh, you're very good. You're
yes,
very good.
Yes.
Did you know that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did you actually just know that, Nat?
Yeah.
That's
very clever. But what about, are you sure that's the same for American magazines?
I'm looking not sure at, a book at now. All. I'm not sure.
Here we go. I have Men's Adventures. Men's Adventures on Tashin. I'm looking here, and it is, yeah, 978, although ISBN 38 anyway. Yeah, I believe you.
I know the book you're talking about, Men's Adventure Magazine's covers.
Correct, yeah, Tashin. What a brand, Tashin. Yeah.
Lovely stuff.
They're so expensive, though.
They get cheaper. Yeah,
well, you can get the little, you get the little pocket size ones that come out afterwards. But you know, if you want to be proper and original, yeah, you do need the first editions. A Tashin is game over.
I like a big book. I like getting a big book and then putting it on my bookshelf and never reading it. I've got so many.
I'm the same. I should send you a picture. I just stare at my bookshelf of just books. I hardly ever read them and flick through them.
So proud of my book collection of big books. But yeah, they're all unopened.
So when you started collecting magazines, was it just a hobby then? Was it just something you liked doing just for fun? Or did you always have this in mind?
It's a good question. I don't think I always had it in mind from the beginning. I guess you guys sound like you're the same. You know, I treasured what I had as a physical object, whether it was records, CDs, comics, books, magazines. I loved them, and I didn't want to just dispose of them quickly. I remember when it was early smash hits in the 80s. You know, you had these things, and they sort of built up, and you thought, no, I want to hold on to these. I think the collecting thing definitely came. It was round about the time when I started working for MTV, and I would just pile all this stuff into crates and send it off into storage because I didn't have enough space for it. But it was that, being a scriptwriter, when I did have one little epiphany moment of, you know, going through Loot. Do you remember Loot magazine?
Oh, yeah.
Anything you needed, a house, a flat, a bike, whatever. It was a brilliant magazine. It's crazy. That's another conversation. But I found an amazing amount of, you know, people were selling all their collections of Q, Empire, all these magazines.
Yeah.
And when I would have, you know, you could get them really cheaply, someone was like chucking them out or emigrating, and you get a whole set of Q, and you realize there was a wealth of information in that. And again, going back to the MTV thing, you know, if there was Prince Weekend, Madonna Weekend, and you had to keep writing about Madonna, well, you just take a great interview out of Rolling Stone or Q, and there was so much meat in it. So that was when I thought, keep these things, definitely there's value in them, but do not chuck them away.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
It's pre-internet, isn't it? So it kind of, like, it only exists in paper.
And other people, I guess, themselves aren't archiving them, right? The publishers of the magazines don't archive.
Not really,
themselves.
No, exactly. They're not. A lot of them are not. I mean, many a time, a lot of publishers have come to me and said, we're missing these issues, we're missing that, have you got this, have you got that? They do not keep thorough archives. You know, there's not many people who actually do, and keep it in a good way as well, no.
So you do keep them, but you lend it out as well, don't you? You lend out magazines and things. Like,
so yeah, we get a lot of inquiries. We lend them for, they've been on lots of TV. You know, again, if you watch good documentaries on television, you know, often they need to refer to something that was in a magazine or have a picture of something. So we loan them, we do research. Lots of brands come to us and they say, look, we need to look at, let's, I don't know, Ray-Ban in the 50s, or I'm doing a documentary on the Beatles, Apple production company. There's so many things. Sport, we just had one yesterday for a very, very famous sports personality, and they need all the stuff on this guy and his life, you know, again, because through magazines it's a great texture, showing everything through magazines.
Yeah, so you have, like, so if you're lending them out as well, do you also try and keep them in sort of pristine mint condition, or is that not at all, you want to have them as an archive that people can use and access?
I think, yeah, we do our best to keep them in pristine condition. I do my best to, you know, make sure they're not ripped and not major OCD levels of everyone's bagged up. I mean, that would just drive me nuts. They're kept pretty well. They're kept very well in a good environment. And yeah, try and keep them. But I think, again, wanting to do the digital is good, but I think it is amazing to have a physical object. You know, people, I do think we are in a interesting world. Everything, yeah, it is all digital. Digital is digital, but physical has that thing too. You know, go to the so many museums and exhibitions. I went to the opening of that Peanuts Charlie Brown thing. Really cool, yes, amazing thing at Somerset House. Loads of paper, comics, things from magazines. It wasn't digital. It was literally a great issue of Life magazine or Time magazine with Schultz or Snoopy on the front. You know, there was the Design Museum had this exhibition on California and the design and how important, you know, California and San Francisco was in design. You know, half that exhibition was like counterculture magazines, Wired and this one. Magazine, you know, they were an artifact. They are very important as a physical thing as much as they are digital.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I totally get you. And that's what I think is like those kind of books, those coffee table books will be exactly the ones that I think will continue beyond the kind of advent of Kindles and things because people like
exactly.
to have that in front of you.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I mean? Do you not get sick of just screen, having it all digitally?
Yeah, I mean, with music, it's so easy to download, but it doesn't mean anything. You know, it's kind of like... I'll buy an album off iTunes and then I'll either change my device or I'll be on to, I'll get a new computer. And I've got, like, I bought an Alice Cooper album online and it had some bonus tracks and I haven't been able to listen to those bonus tracks for like 10 years because I got a new computer and it didn't follow over. And also I bought loads of albums on iTunes that I've just never listened to because what's the point? But if you've got a record, it's sitting there looking at you and you go, okay, right, I'm going to put that on. Or if it's a CD, but also with books, I like having a physical book to carry around with me.
You can, exactly. You know, downtime, you're on the tube, you're travelling somewhere, on the bog, whatever. You have something physical. And the other thing, it's pretty obvious, I mean, print and the written word has been around for thousands of years. You know, a lot of these new medias, even cinema, cinema's just over 100 years, the visual flickering images, 100, I don't know the exact. But, you know, the writing and that whole, that is being around a long, long time.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But also, in terms of collecting stuff obsessively, it's when you started collecting, there must have been like a tipping point where, because for instance, so I've got all of the Studio Ghibli. Ghibli?
I think it's Ghibli.
I've got all the Studio Ghibli films on DVD or Blu-ray.
And lovely,
that was a thing where it was just like, oh, I've got. I end up with five of them over time and they've got numbers on the spine and then you go well fuck it, I might as well just get them all. And so then it was a thing where I'd sort of like go out and collect, and same with Dario Argento, where I kind of like ended, I, you know, over time I had like three or four Dario Argento films and then it's just like, well, right, I'm just going to get all of them. And then
you've got the collecting bug. I mean, I need to curb it a bit. I used to do like even two of every magazine, one to keep immaculate and one to keep so people could read it and use it. I mean, Guy, actually, fresh in my memory last night, I've never seen it in full. You guys have probably seen it, The Warriors.
Oh, yeah.
Quick shout out to John Viner. But here's another guy. He's obsessed with this film. He'll have, I don't know, 50 versions of that film on DVD, Laserdisc, VHS, Greek VHS, cinema prints. You know, if you are into something and you're... dare I say, you know, obsessive, OCD, whatever. I mean, maybe I'm using OCD in the wrong context, not in its true meaning, but there must be a degree of OCD. You collect. You need it. You need to complete.
Yeah.
Hunter-gathering, you know, cavemen.
That's basically what this show is, I think. It's about being a fan of something or being enthusiastic about something. So that's what that is.
It's been really nice talking to you, James. So we've got to wrap
Thank
up.
You.
But thank you for talking to us, and maybe we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks again.
Thank you
Thanks,
very much.
Guys.
Cheers. All right.
Bye.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Okay, now we've got to play a song. What's your song?
I've got a few up. Have I,
just play, say one song.
Do Hounds of Love.
It's in the trees. It's coming.
When I was a child, running in the night, afraid. I don't know.
On FUBAR Radio.
We're doing it! We're doing it! Right, we're back after... We're into our second hour.
Second hour of the show.
We're joined in the studio by Matthew Holness.
Hello.
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 Is it Matt or Matthew?
Either or.
Oh, really good. Yep. You're really laid back about that.
Yeah, that's fine.
really big fan of yours. When I was younger, loved Garth Marenghi's Dark Place.
Yeah, yeah.
And recently I bought a collection of short films and I saw your Gun for George.
That's right, yeah.
Which is great. You've just written and directed your first feature film.
Horror film.
Because you've been making short films for a while, haven't you?
Yeah, I've made three. So I've made Gun for George was the first one, and then I made a film called The Snipist for Sky Arts, mm-hmm. and I also made a short comedy film called Smutch for Sky Arts as well.
Oh, Smutch, I've not seen that.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw the other two this week. I'd seen A Gun for George. I think it'd been one of those things where I never knew where it was on, but it often, in probably quite an appropriate way, seemed to show up late at night, and you'd
go,
and you'd sort of catch odd 5 minutes of it here and there and go, what was that? I want to see that from the beginning.
Yeah, that's good. That's the perfect way to catch things,
I think. It feels like it. And what was the kind of influence on that Gun for George?
Well, that was, I guess, growing up with shows like The Sweeney, that kind of thing. It was intended to be a kind of parody, in a similar way to Dark Place did for horror. It was supposed to be a kind of parody of crime dramas, that sort of thing, but actually during the filming of it became something far more serious, really. So and it wasn't meant to be like that until started filming, and then it became something else.
Yeah, it wasn't as light.
No, certainly wasn't.
No,
but it does feel like that seems like a halfway house, that movie, between what sort of something like Garth Marenghi and the kind of films you're making now, right?
So the film, we didn't say what the title of the film was.
Oh, sorry, yes.
The film that is, when is it out?
It's out today.
The film is Possum.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, I haven't seen it because we got a screener and we've had a screener in the past and I don't like watching films on a laptop, but I am going to go and see it at the cinema. But I'm...
Great.
I saw it. You've seen it.
And it isn't at all. There's nothing. It's definitely like a proper psychological thriller.
Yes. Yeah. There are no jokes. Nothing funny or enjoyable in it. Yeah. No, it's about as dark and bleak as it gets, really.
When I was reading about it, it says this. You can sort of see there's a real influence of kind of 70s films in it from the... Like the title card is the first thing that kind of shows up and you go, oh, here we go.
Yes. I mean, it's partly the intention because the character... hasn't moved on from that period in their life when they were younger. So, and because we're, you know, the audience is watching the events of the film through the character's point of view, everything is kind of coloured by his memories of that era. So it's less an exercise in retro nostalgia, but more about, you know, that's psychologically where he is and where he's, you know, that's where he's trapped still.
there's definitely bits of that. It does sort of, well, it has a feel of something like a public information film, mm. those kind of things, doesn't it? Has that sort of.
That's right. Well, they used to put those out, you know, between children's programmes when I grew up. So.
What, the, were, the don't play on train lines yeah, and stuff? Yeah. They were horrific as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, they and, you know, used to see them so often. And they, you know, and they just stuck in, you know, my mind and in millions of other children that grew up at that time. So. You know, they were part of the wallpaper. So yeah, the film This Possum is very much drawing on that kind of collective memory of these rather traumatic and harrowing films that we, you know, was really our first introduction to the adult world.
Yeah,
in many
yeah.
ways.
I yeah. was born in 79. You were 1980.
80.
But I sort of grew up with those as well. I think
yeah.
there's a funny thing that seems to be, like, people born within this sort of stretch of like 10 or 20 years almost saw exactly the same
yeah,
culture.
I mean, they played them over and over. And weirdly, I mean, I was born mid-70s and I grew up in the 80s. But oddly enough, I'm sort of attached to the 70s because they were repeating all the 70s yeah. programs in the 80s. So I did watch things like The Sweeney, watch The Professionals, mm-hmm. all those kinds of things.
Watch What Crappens would like to think it's...
What was that?
Ghost in the Machine.
Okay, carry on.
That was terrifying. Well, it is our Halloween special.
Well, there we are.
So we've now got actual ghosts.
Is it a Halloween special? I don't think it's a Halloween
no,
special.
We thought I'd just say it was. Well, I've no idea what happened.
It's my Halloween special anyway.
Oh, well.
Yeah, so
well, if
I'm feeling
was,
it.
If this was a 70s sort of spooky film set in a radio studio, that'd be the first thing that would happen.
That's right. That's the.
You just get a little yeah. tiny bit, and as it yeah. would go on, it would escalate.
That's it. We're not getting out of here.
No.
Sure.
But this would go dark, the screen, yeah. you wouldn't see the studio.
It's the thing around here. I'm doing a show, which is sort of like a horror parody, in the Pleasance next door.
Oh, yes,
and
yeah.
It was our opening night last night. And when we started, we'd rehearsed all week and we'd bought all the props and all the costumes. We got everything ready, and it's like a musical thing. And just as it started, we were all about to go on stage, and the music starts and we start going on stage. And then the fucking pub quiz from downstairs comes over our radio mics, and it was just like we've got all of that, this haze in the air and all the lighting and everything. And then all of a sudden, it's like question 7: which Tom Hanks film?
perhaps it added an extra layer or something. There's probably people there that thought, oh, that was quite clever.
Yeah, someone said, I thought it was really good because it made it feel really kind of like unnerving.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it's he only does Thursdays, though, the pub quiz. Anyway, so what were we talking about? We're talking about public information films.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. I was just saying that sort of, it's got that sort of tone of it. And I guess also like those BBC ghost stories as well. I'm sort of thinking like there's... Warning to the Curious, that one was the one I was thinking of.
Yeah, all those Lawrence Gordon Clark films, The Ghost Tours Christmas, so you've got The Signalman, and you've also the Jonathan Miller one, Whistle and I'll Come to You, which was earlier. I think it was about 10 years before that.
Was it filmed in Norfolk, Possum?
Possum was, yeah.
So filmed. It's sort of similar, that Suffolk,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I think they used some locations in Norfolk, so yeah, they kind of shot in the same... That was kind of partly the you know, that informed the decision to shoot in Norfolk to a certain extent because I wanted to capture the feel of those
ghost stories. Yeah, that's what it kind of reminds me of. Those kind of, the kind of scenery there just feels very kind of similar. Or
yeah, it's great. It's very flat and strange and atmospheric. Yeah.
And what's this about? It's about Jimmy Savile?
It's not about Jimmy Savile. It's really about... I guess it's about that. It is certainly about that monster. It's certainly about, you know, the horror of child molesters, child abductors, and it's not something that is really the topic for horror films that much. And oddly enough, it's been covered an awful lot in crime dramas. And you know, pick any crime drama on the TV. That's you know, more often than not the plot. That's, you know, that's the crime that's being investigated. But I think it's got to a point where it's so common in crime dramas that it's almost partly it's cliche now. And two, I guess there's an inbuilt sense of there's almost a just that inbuilt sense that, you know, the forces of good, the forces of law and justice are there. They're going to, you know, confront and you know, destroy the evil that we're seeing in those crime narratives. And I think that horror doesn't really do that because there isn't that inbuilt sense of justice prevailing. And I think that was what drew me to this, because I think, you know, if the horror film I think should be able to confront the ultimate monster, that, you know, the monsters that are in every street, you know, every town has a monster of this kind, and it felt to me that you know it should confront them, but without being exploitative in any way. So I guess there is something, one of the strengths of it is that, you know, it's unpleasant because there isn't, you know, there's no one in Possum that is, yeah, is fighting for him. There isn't,
sure,
there's no policeman, there's no, I mean, the policemen are all, you know, figures of terror as well, you know. So it's that kind of paranoid atmosphere, but it was important to kind of portray, you know, a crime like that and a horror like that that has no closure for victims, you know, to portray it truthfully and as sensitively as possible.
No, that's great. And also, horror films are meant to, not meant to, but there's a history of horror films that are used as metaphors for actual things that are, yeah, happening in the real world.
Yeah. Well, I think most, you know, all good horror films are kind of that, you know, even if they don't, even if they don't start out being that, you look back and you realise these films are about different, you know, particular things in the world. I read a really good book on post 9/11 horror in American cinema. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic book, and it just lists all the kind of tropes, the different films and things that are kept recurring in films. And it's only like coming back 10 years or 15 years after that event, you see what all these films are kind of on about. You know, yeah, they're not literally about what, you know, what they seem to be about further down the line. And I think horror films always kind of, you know, they come up in these moments of great anxiety and great, you know, well, world terror. And
like in the early 70s when just after Vietnam and they had, yeah, all the footage of, you know, dead bodies on TV.
That's right.
And then the horror films were just like, well, we can't really compete with that. And, yeah, so then you'd get films like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, mm-hmm, where it was kind of, where people's tolerance levels had sort of gone up so, yeah, much that things started becoming really hardcore and hyper-realistic. And
that's right, yeah.
And then also you've got like all the Atomic Age kind of films, yeah, which are, and I'm not sure that they all thought, oh, let's all band together and make a decade of worth of films that are all about the atom, mm, bomb. But when you look back on it, you go, yeah, you can definitely categorize them as like 1950s.
Yeah,
you
know? I mean, they're all tapping into an anxiety that was being felt, absolutely.
And they might not even know they're doing it themselves, I suppose.
That's
they
right, yeah.
They pick up more. No, the news,
it's like, hey, atom bomb films are good, or we need like a giant ant. How's that going to have,
yes,
happened?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it will be atomic rays. That'll be it. And then, you know, you have kind of like stuff like Terminator, where everyone gets killed in a nuclear war, and it's kind of like, oh right, yeah, so that's because, you know, we were all paranoid about Russia at the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're,
yeah,
not anymore.
Yeah.
Obviously, Russia aren't a problem. But it's great living in 2018 where everything's been fixed.
We're living in the future.
We are the future, isn't that? But yeah, I think that's really fun. I wrote my not a thesis, my
dissertation.
My dissertation, yeah, on horror films, and that's what I learned from that, which was just kind of like.
Stephen King wrote an excellent book on that very topic called Dance Macabre, and it is one of the greatest books ever written on you know what horror is, what it does, when it, you know, when it's popular and why it's popular when it is. It's, you know, it's just a fantastic book.
Yeah.
And the possum of the film,
mm,
it's funny that it's called a possum. It's a puppet,
yeah,
essentially. But when you're imagining, oh, a possum, because I read the book first in Robin Instead,
yeah,
anthology,
yeah, yeah,
Dead Funny.
Yeah, it was reprinted in that. Yeah,
yeah. It wasn't from there originally?
No, it's originally from an anthology called The New Uncanny by Comma Press, that are Manchester-based short story publisher. So they commissioned the original story, and the idea was to look at Freud's dissertation, or his, you know, his essay on the uncanny, and to reinterpret the fears that he listed there for a kind of modern reader. So that was the brief that led to the initial story.
I read it in Dead Funny, which was like an anthology of like horror stories by,
right,
comedians,
yeah,
and comedy actors and people sort of in the comedy world. But that was one I remember reading Possum in that and being, it was almost, it was much more disturbing than anything else in the book. And I found it like really kind of odd and sort,
yeah,
of And even then, I had this thing where I couldn't really visualise what the puppet was.
Yeah, yeah.
And you just have these sort of, it's very sort of visceral, and you get sort of, it's all sort of how it feels. And
yeah,
things.
I mean, it was much more a kind of Frankenstein's monster in the story, because it's kind of stitched together from, you know, bits of dead animals, roadkill, all these sorts of horrific, gruesome things. And in the film, it's changed from that. It's more. It's kind of a human spider.
Yes. How long ago did you write the story?
2008. It was commissioned 2007. I think I wrote and it was published 2008.
And then when did you start work on the film?
Probably around about 2013-14, I think. Because I hadn't even thought about filming it at any point. It was just a story that was commissioned and did it and really enjoyed writing it, but I didn't really think of it as a film. But then I was watching a lot of German silent horror films from the 1920s, and I was obsessed with, these silent films because they seemed to be able to express horrors that were on the surface level. The stories were about something completely different, but these were films that were basically allowing people to discuss the horrors of the First World War and to kind of express that in some way. And I found it interesting because I thought, could you do a silent horror film now? They were so wonderful, and I was really keen to think, could you do that? Could you actually tell a story like that visually? And then I realized that with Possum, the short story, there was a character that couldn't express what they'd gone through, had constructed a reality, a puppet that they were projecting all these unspoken horrors onto, and that suddenly became something that I felt could be told, because this was a character that wouldn't speak, wouldn't tell, wouldn't say what had happened to them, but they'd literally just built this thing that expressed it. So that way, I thought, that is a story that could be a kind of modern silent horror film.
Yeah.
I was surprised to see it on the posters for it, on the underground and things, because it's almost, I think that's one of the sort of powerful things about watching it, is that when you actually see it and you start seeing bits of it, it's that kind of, oh God, what is that?
Well, that's it. You kind of keep it back for as long as possible and generate, some tension and some suspense. And as you say, it's called Possum, but it's more spider-like. But Possum is really the kind of the metaphorical sense of meaning of playing dead, being still. Will it wake up? Is it going to wake up? When will it wake up? Is, playing dead to protect oneself? Just that, all that kind of implied meaning from that kind of metaphorical sense, I guess.
So when did you make your first short?
Back in 2010, I believe.
So Dark Place was 2004?
2004, yeah.
And
Made it 2003, and it was televised 2004.
I loved it so much.
Well, thank you.
I was doing theatre and education at the time, touring around the country, and it was miserable. And me and my mate, Ben from Essex, whatever night it was, Tuesday or Thursday, we used to come in and watch that. And it would be big relief. I just loved it.
Cheers.
And so then, I was at, so when did you do Garth Marenghi, the live show?
Well, that was some years before then. We took a show called Garth Marenghi's Fright Night up to Edinburgh for the festival in 2000. And we were fortunate enough to be nominated for the Perrier that year. And so we followed up the year after with Garth Marenghi's Netherhead. And that was the year that where we won the Perry Award.
Did you do one in 1999?
No, what did I do in 1999?
Well, did you do one in the 90s? Because we were in school, so I did my first Edinburgh in 1997 with my secondary school. And then a bunch of people went to see Garth Marenghi.
I don't know
if it was 97 or 98.
I performed the character in the Footlights Review, and that would have been about 95, I think, 1995 or 1996, can't remember. But I was in the Cambridge Footlights University comedy group, and definitely the character of Garth started then.
Yeah. A bunch of people went to see it, and they said, you've got to go and see him. And then there was a girl that I fancied that was going out with my friend, and I was just like, I'm not going to listen to you. a few years later, your show came out. I was like, oh, it's good, isn't it? So that was 2004, and then you did Man to Man with Dean Lerner.
Yeah.
Are you from St Albans, or did you live in
St
Albans?
No, I lived there for a while, yeah.
I lived in St Albans. I used to see you around...
did you?
Yeah, I used to see... Oh, there he is. I'd see you at, the train station and Threshers and stuff, and I'd be like, there he is.
Well, I couldn't drive then, you see, so I couldn't get out of St Albans.
But one can get out.
And, St Albans is beautiful, but it's quite small. And
it's a nice place to visit.
Yeah, if you can't kind of move out, it becomes a little bit cramped.
Yes, yeah, I found that. Yeah.
Especially especially with me walking around.
Yeah, sure. So that was when was Man to Man with Dean Lerner?
That was 2005, 2006.
And so then after that, you went on to do, and you were in the office. And then you went on to do
not very much.
No, but it's a standout part, isn't it? It's one of the ones that, you know, you remember it.
I think it meant not very much after Man to Man, because there were a few years there where I didn't really do much at all. The actual office.
So in 2010 you did your first short film, and so your first short film, which was
Gun for George.
Right.
Yeah.
And so how did that come about?
Well, that came about, I'd actually written a feature-length script called Shock Absorber, which was kind of an early stage of that, an early version of Gun for George. But the thing was, I hadn't really figured out how you write feature film scripts at that stage, so it was completely overlong and going off, you know, various tangents, and wasn't, you know, in all likelihood was not a good script. I can't bear to like revisit it, so it probably is a pretty bad script, but I think that I was with I got to meet Peter Colton, who was working at Film 4 then, and he then moved to Warp Films, and he said, you know, I'd like to continue to develop this project, you know, and it was at that point that there was a suggestion that we could make a short film for Film 4, you know, let's try this out, try out the character, try out the world, and see what happens. So that then became Gun for George, which, oddly enough, I then tried to turn into a different feature following that, and got all caught up in, you know, a rather huge case of writer's block. Right. because of the tonal shift in it, because Gun for George is both funny and tragic, I guess.
Yeah.
And it kind of, it's funny because you can kind of balance it in a short film. And then I tried to repeat that in a longer script, and the problem with that is the tonal, I couldn't get the tonal shifts right, and it just became, you know, neither one thing nor the other. It was neither a funny film nor a tragic. Then the pressure was, could it be one or the other? And by that point, I'd kind of lost focus on it.
That called?
I was going to be called The Reprisalizer.
Yeah,
and
that's
I hope to kind of go back and do it again at some point. I'd like to still make it when I've figured out the best way of kind of doing it, really.
And is that character aware of the equaliser, or does it exist in a world without the equaliser?
I don't think Terry Fitch is aware of anything other than the hell going on in his head, really. So
it's interesting, you know, that in Garth Marenghi you're playing a horror writer, but then outside of that you are also a horror writer. And film he's a writer of thrillers. And
well, writers really interest me, and particularly kind of failed writers or failing writers. And I mean, I love pulp writers. I love the kind of writers that churn out so much stuff over and over again. And you know, writers that don't necessarily get, you know, those kind of writers that were writing to pay their bills and were, you know, hammering this stuff out. And I have huge respect for them, because the ones that, you know, you haven't heard about. I mean, there's one guy that is one of my favourite writers of all time. He's called Harry Whittington. And he just churned out these pulp novels in the 1950s and 60s, and he wrote westerns, he wrote noir novels, he wrote nurse sagas, he wrote swamp crime novels, all these kind of very, very strange subgenres that came out in the first pulp paperback boom. But he was always writing to pay the bills, and he was just a working writer, and he was incredibly successful in his day, but then became incredibly unsuccessful and ended up writing pornographic novels simply to pay the bills. And it's that kind of and I still think he's an absolutely master at plotting. He's a fantastic writer, but the sad thing is that hardly anyone knows about him. And yet I've probably learned more about writing from studying his books than anything else, really.
Right, sure.
We get that, there's that, what they call them, journeymen, don't they? Oh, journeymen, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's people that write a word count, and they should be to achieve this, I need to write 3,000 words a day, otherwise I'm not going to get paid, or I'm not going to...
And you read about some of these writers, and the word, I mean, someone like Earl Stanley Gardner, I think, would just churn out thousands and thousands and thousands of words a day. I mean, I can manage at most 1500 words on a good day. And they would write, you know, but you know, 5 or 6,000 words a day, and they'd still have time to, you know, break off and do whatever else they're doing that day. It's amazing.
So at the time when you were writing Garth Marenghi, were you also harbouring ambition self to go, well, I'm going to write horror as well? So you're going to be...
Yeah, I always wanted to. And, I read a lot of ghost stories and horror stories. And, yeah, I've always had, and I published a few, not many, but, a few stories in anthologies at that time as well. And I was just sort of learning how to do it at that stage, really, learning how to kind of write ghost stories and horror stories.
It's funny that out of everyone in it, there's you, Richard Ayoade, and Alice Lowe have all made feature films.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So it's,
yeah.
Was that something that was always discussed? Was it always ambitions?
No, not at all.
Here,
no, I mean, I didn't really have any intention to direct until Gun for George, where, in fact, it was in a Film 4 meeting when they said, who have you got in mind to direct this? And I hadn't really got anyone in mind. And then Peter Carlton very kindly said, oh, well, Matthew will direct it, and kind of threw me in the deep end. But I'm so grateful to him for doing that, because he's kind of set me along this path, really. I don't think I would have done that. Alice, I think, I can't speak for her. I don't know if she wanted a director at that stage. I think she did, actually, because she was producing lots of short films shortly in and around that period and shortly after. So I think she's always been keen on that side of things. And she's absolutely brilliant. And Prevenge, I think, is an absolutely wonderful film. Mm. Richard was always wanting to be a director. He wanted to direct Dark Place, and so did. And so we kind of always knew that he would go off and direct. But I think it's interesting because, Rich and I really wanted to do a second series of Dark Place, and we pitched it to Channel 4. But they didn't want it. They thought it was too hard a show for an audience to kind of get into. So they said, we want something with less barriers to understanding. So that was the case. So I think, and Man to Man I didn't enjoy and I didn't like, and that was really a compromise show, because that was the sort of show that they were happy for us to make, but they didn't, because they didn't want anything like Dark Place. So that experience I found, quite disappointing, because it was not remotely creatively fulfilling at all. And it was just not Richard and I at our best. We just, we stopped writing together at that point, because it was just not going well at all. And I think mainly because I've been unable to get anything else on TV like, I guess, Dark Place, because I really don't think we would ever have got that opportunity again. We certainly wouldn't get it today. I think all of us that do that kind of thing have branched out into film because that's kind of, because we can't do TV in an odd way. Sure. Well, certainly I feel that for myself. I don't feel I can get anything like that on TV. And also I'm too old to do that kind of stuff now. So.
But you have more control as a filmmaker, right?
Yeah, you do. And I would say, the worst thing, the best thing for me was starting to direct, because you're suddenly taken a lot more seriously as a writer. If you're just a writer on something, that, it stops, respect for what you do stops at a certain point, and you really have to start directing for people to listen to you again beyond that point.
But when you direct your own words, you can say as a director, well, we've got to change the ending, and then you can just turn around and say, I'm not changing anything. We're not changing anything then. And if you're in it as well, you go, I'm not saying this rubbish. You are. I'm the director. You're doing what the writer says.
It's funny,
you can imagine it. It would be hilarious. It's a little skit.
I do see comedy on TV sometimes, and it's funny that you go, you can see what the joke is, and it feels like whoever's made it has just not understood that that is the joke. Well, do you know what I mean? You can hear it, and you go, but that's not, you've not played that as if it's a joke.
It's hard to do, and they so rarely let people kind of practice and get on with it. In TV they're very hesitant to sort of let people play with the tools, in a sense. And you've got to be able to do that, or you don't learn how to do it.
You do. What's great about doing stand up is that there's no filter between what your ideas are. And also, this play is the first theatre I've done in 10 years.
And I've
completely understood whilst doing it why I stopped doing it, because it's so much fucking work. And doing stand-up was just kind of like a lot easier, or a lot less complicated. But when you do stand-up, you can just go up on stage and you kind of have an idea and you say it in front of the audience and you make them laugh, and then people from TV, they go, oh, we love you. Oh, you're so good. Let's put you on TV. But don't do that. And then you're just like, well, I can't do the things that you liked in the first place. I did a show which got a lot of comedians on, and then And then we were sort of like made to change everything that we did. Mm. And it was kind of like, oh God, everything was deeply compromised. Mm. And you go, this isn't the show that we want to make, and this isn't the show you want to make.
And we, I completely agree. I think that that was very similar. Not totally dissimilar to that then. We had a brilliant producer, Charlie, who was able to kind of just put a slight protective wall up against us and interference from the channel for Dark Place. And I think, you know, we would always be very grateful to him for that, because he kind of just created an environment for us to do what we wanted to do. And I think it's really rare that that happens.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, hugely instrumental in I think allowing an environment that gave us that wonderful opportunity, basically.
I think it is really rare. I mean, you see something like I don't know, House of Fools, and you go, I fully believe that is the show that they wanted to make.
Yeah,
and
they,
you know, but you especially with new comedians, yeah. when people get in their first big break, you go, yeah, but that's kind of like it's. I don't know how rare it is, because I haven't done so much, but I know I did a show called Heavy Entertainment, and basically it's maybe not the edit, but I think in the edit it ended up being kind of, but when we were actually filming it, it was exactly what the best that we could make it, and exactly, and we never got that opportunity again. And it's kind of like, it was like a go for broke thing, where this is our one shot at doing this series. And I had a producer, Rupert Magendie, and he basically protected me the whole way.
Yeah.
But then so often you work with, not so often, I've worked with a lot of amazing producers, but sometimes every so often you work with, no, not you two in the booth. you're awful. But some, it's, you have those rare times when they know that you are, there's like a whole kind of like flume of comedians down the pike that are all going to come along, and they want to protect their job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's kind of like, you're gone tomorrow.
That's
but I've got to deal with my superiors for like
that's it, and that's
years
kind of,
to come.
That's TV, and you know, and I think that's why, you know, slowly, the more you do, you find people that you really work with and you really click with, and that's the ideal, that you slowly find like-minded people that you work well with, and you kind of iron out those, you know, because there are always people like that, and you know, that's always been the case, you know, and you do need to look after yourself and look after those that you respect.
There's always a cunt on every production. but then there's also like, but that's the thing, you know, when I did Uncle, it was kind of like, you go, oh, I love the art department and I'll use them forever.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you find like a makeup department, and when I did Heavy Entertainment, I found a costume department, and you go kind of like, and then you kind of, it's like a snowball going down the mountain.
I mean, the short film I did, Smutch, which was just before we filmed Possum, and I worked with Spencer Millman, who had produced Man to Man with us, and also Dennis DeGroote, who was the production designer for Dark Place. And it's just great when you can, because you know, you've worked on stuff, you know how each other works. So it's
like the gang getting back together again.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you go, well, we'll get Charlotte in to do the art department, because she gets me and she knows what the tone is. And then also you can have, like, you're not having creative discussions whilst at the same time having a get to know you
kind of thing. Yeah.
It's kind of like you hit the ground running with that.
I think I know what you mean. It does feel like something, from my point of view as well, something like Garth Marenghi feels like that's something that's what you intended to put on screen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whereas I feel like now sort of the comedians of mine and Nick's generation feel like they are put into things.
Yeah.
So it's more like, rather than saying, well, there's lots of like really great talented people.
But it's so harder to get seen though, because there's so many, you know.
Yes,
I think,
yeah.
You know, I really don't know how Edinburgh as a festival works anymore, because I've not really been up there, but I think we were pretty lucky in that there was just more chance of being seen. But I think if you were starting out now, I don't know, I imagine it's just so hard, and there's so many people want to get on TV and do that stuff that, you know, it's harder to kind of be noticed,
I guess.
There
are so many comedians, there are so many TV channels, and there are so many shows, and it's just, you go, I don't know. I mean,
it should be a world of opportunity, shouldn't it? I mean, there should be room for all to do exactly
what
you want to do.
It feels like it should be more idiosyncratic, and you could get more sort of stranger things or more unusual things that might find its audience.
But they all expect you to do stuff for free. That's the problem.
Well, you have to do stuff for free because otherwise you look like a fucking cunt. Because you've got to do it. You've got. Everyone else. Not everyone else. I've worked with amazing people. I still want to work. But you know. But they kind of like go. You put in extra hours, and everyone puts in extra hours. I mean, when you've got a tight budget, you know, the art department will put in extra hours, the costume department will put in extra hours, the hair and makeup people will get there early and they'll leave late. They're like the
Absolutely,
first people on set,
and
they put in 2 hours of free work in the morning before everyone else turns up and gets paid. Mm. And then they're the ones that are packing down at the end of the day, and they do it because their work ends up on screen, and they will be judged for that. And it's just like, it doesn't matter if you're getting paid for it or not, it's going to be end up on screen, and so it's got to be as good as possible. So you've got to put in the extra work. It's kind of like you could do the 9-to-5 thing where you turn up and then you leave at the end of the day, but your work will suffer for it. So you have to put in all the extra time in order to, you know, kind of pride. It's self-pride, really, just of your work.
But you should look at the Harlan Ellison clip. He's a science fiction writer, and he does this absolutely wonderful explosion at the notion of being asked to work for free. And I think it is. I mean, I agree wholeheartedly with him, and I think he's just absolutely how dare you ask me to work for free.
Well, no one should work for free. One should, but
it's the expectation that you should, you know, write, and this comes down to writers, and you know, writers are really not very well respected in my experience, and I think it's that they, you know, people expect, oh well, you're hungry, there's loads of people that are competing with you, so if you want to, you know, you'll do it for free. Yes. And I think it's awful.
You get that in comedy.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going to pay you, but you need to bring 4 friends, and you'll get a drink. And you go, oh, it's a long way to go for a drink, isn't it?
I remember doing a stand-up gig in London with my mate Spencer, and we'd agreed to do it, I think, for £20 each. And we went to get paid, asked for our payment afterwards, and he said, oh, yeah, it's been... We said £3, did we, like that? And we absolutely kicked off.
Of course.
And I'm glad we did, because then he just thought, oh yeah, how much was it really? 10, was it? No, 20, like that. And you go, oh, all right then.
I think the expectations become so low, though, that you go there and you go, oh, it's really nice, I'm not getting paid, but someone's put a lovely jug of water for us.
Yeah, that's it.
So we can have a
that's
nice
the thing,
glass
you go,
of water.
Oh, they've got us some water.
Sweet.
That's lovely.
A lovely promoter.
By the way, it was £50 for this, yes?
If you talk to Natalie at the end.
Yeah, Natalie sorts the financial stuff. We're going to play your song now. What's your song?
Well, I've picked, it's not really a song, it's a theme tune. It's I love John Carpenter.
Did you see him last week?
I did see him last week.
Oh, we were there.
And I'd seen him a couple of years ago as well.
Yeah, we were there.
You were there, were you?
Yeah.
It's fantastic. And I've picked the track I've picked that he's done is In the Mouth of Madness.
Yeah.
And it's, the reason is, In the Mouth of Madness was a huge influence on Rich and I when we were creating Dark Place, but it's still a huge influence on stuff now. I think all his work is great, and I just love this track. So this is like his re-recorded version.
I'd only seen In the Mouth of Madness within the last year. I'm not a huge John Carpenter fan. It's one of those ones that I've always heard is kind of like one of his 90s.
Yeah, that's
what was it. Children of the Corn. What was it?
Village of the Damned.
And it's like, okay, I like John Carpenter. I don't need to see bad John Carpenter. I was saving it in my back pocket for, like, you know, when he passes on.
Well, it's very, at times it felt very silly, which is why, you know, I kind of enjoyed watching it when we were putting together Dark Place. But actually, the older I get, I just think it's kind of come into its own.
I think it's an incredible film.
And that is actually what happened with The Thing, because when I grew up, for years, The Thing was seen as not very good and like a real poor man's Alien kind of thing.
Yeah.
And The Thing has since become... I think Carpenter's films really come into their own further along the line.
I've never even compared The Thing to Alien in my head.
Mm.
No.
But
Alien was always the kind of the Alien horror film that was the classic. And then The Thing has just slowly crept up and taken over.
I always see Alien as a science fiction film, though, and The Thing is a horror film. So I guess I've never crossed them over in my head. But John Carpenter is his own genre, really.
Yeah.
And In the Mouth of Madness is an incredible film. So...
Thank you.
Got to have it. Got to play it all out. We're back in the clubhouse. We're in the studio with Matthew Holness. So that was John Carpenter in The Mouth of Madness.
And we've basically been talking about it off air for what
5 minutes. That's a 5.5 minute track.
And you've missed all that.
You missed all that, but it was all good. What's your favourite John Carpenter film? Is it In the Mouth of Madness?
No, The Thing. The Thing is my absolute favourite.
I think it
favorite.
Is the best. We were saying at The Thing that Mouth of Madness now might be third favourite.
Come on.
I'd say The Thing, then what was the second one I had? Oh, Halloween, I think.
Yeah. Mm.
And then possibly In the Mouth of Madness.
Halloween is one of those films that hasn't aged well because of all of the rip-offs.
You reckon?
Oh, I don't know.
I think that once you've seen, all of the Halloween films, all of the Friday the 13th films, all of the Nightmare on Elm Street films, you get through them all, and then you go back and watch the first Halloween, you're kind of like going, yeah, get on with it.
But I think that Halloween is special, though, because you do have that thing where, now you've got that thing where you go, oh, well, this one was made a year before Halloween, and Halloween's basically a rip-off of that.
Yeah,
and you watch it and you go, yeah, it's rubbish, isn't it? You go, and that's what Halloween isn't. It's really good.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So it is that. It is still a cut above, and it is still, like, odd and slightly uncanny.
It's got amazing. I mean, all the music for all of his films was always good, and it has got an amazing score.
The bit where he sort of appears just, doing a sort of sidestep through some bushes and walking back is something that shouldn't really work. It feels it's quite a silly idea.
It's also
it works.
There's one moment in it where he's basically created what is now the absolute modern cliche of horror films, which is when the baddie is standing at some distance and just clocks their head to one side.
Yeah.
That's actually in there. Not face on, but when he's looking at the guy that he's just stabbed to the wall and he just turns his head. And you kind of go, Carpenter had done all that. He's just nailed it all in that one film, you know.
But also, when he showed the first cut to the producers, they were just like, this is rubbish. Because it didn't have any music to it, and they were just, this isn't scary. This is rubbish. And then he went away and he did the score in 3 days. And he was just like, right, we've got to have some scary music. And I think that really does add to the film. I like Halloween. I love John Carpenter, but I would say that it's not one that I have to revisit that often. Whereas The Thing, I can watch over and over again. Big Trouble in Little China, I can watch over and over again. In the Mouth of Madness is still very new to me. But like, then there's stuff like Escape from New York, which I can't be bothered with. And Escape, it's just like, it's
can't
not. It's not The Warriors. I think The Warriors is like almost like the same film but better. And Escape from New York doesn't really do it for me. And Escape from LA, talk about Bruce Campbell films that he absolutely. I mean, I went to see it because Bruce Campbell was in it.
But it's interesting. One thing what we were talking about while that was playing was that there are some Carpenter films that I feel are kind of classic, undiscovered classic Carpenters.
Because
I think Christine is incredibly good now, and I never used to really rate it among Carpenter's films. Now I it's fast creeping up to be one of my absolute favourites, and I almost feel like his films become greater the longer they're around.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It does. It feels like They Live has really found its time now, and the middle
section of They Live.
Right. Yeah. But it does feel like that was a film that for years I was just like, I didn't care for it.
And then you see it
again and go, oh, I'm an idiot.
But I think that a lot of his films I really love the basketball sequence in Escape from LA. And it sort of tricks you into going back and watching Escape from LA and then going, oh, it's awful though. And but with They Live, it's kind of like that fight in the alleyway. It kind of like you go into it and then you realise that you actually have to sit through very boring 20 minutes right at the top.
It makes me wonder if in 10 years' time we're all going to be somewhere and we're all going to go, guys, I've just seen Escape from LA and it is the best film I've ever seen.
Well, I think Ghosts of Mars is going that way.
Yeah.
I remember seeing Ghosts of Mars at the cinema.
That's his fourth remake of Rio Bravo.
Yeah. Right. And I remember thinking, oh no, this is, oh, I really wanted to like this. Now that's just come out on Blu-ray now. But weirdly enough, it's already of more interest than it was to me at the time, simply because it's all old Hollywood techniques. It's on film. It looks a lot older than you remember it being.
Jason Statham's got hair.
Yeah. and it's kind of there's lots of back projection and just these old classic techniques that are just not used anymore.
Because when was that made?
I think that came out in 97, 98, something like that. Because Vampires came out just after it, didn't it?
Yeah. And what do you think about Vampires? John Carpenter's Vampires, not to be confused with anyone else's Vampires.
It's quite nasty and a little bit, slightly dodgy in places, but it's a good film.
It's really disappointing, the look of the actual vampires. They all look like goths. And it's kind of like, it's sort of cliched, but it's also shit. It's just like, you go, these aren't just any vampires, these are John Carpenter's vampires. And they're sort of like, there's a sort of lack of imagination. And then like a couple of years, maybe about the same time, a couple of years earlier was From Dusk Till Dawn, right?
Yeah.
And then you've got a vampire film that's kind of like really span it on its head. And it's like,
but then again, you know, it's weird. We'll kind of look back and those films will be, there'll be a cluster of films that define that kind of era of horror film. Do you know what I mean? I think there is a look to that. I've noticed this with the whole, you know, Stranger Things thing coming out. There's, you know, just the fonts. Actually, it's kind of, the obsession is moving on from those sort of 80s fonts and 80s style to actually, I think, kind of the 90s horror paperbacks. There's something about the fonts used and the look of those things that is becoming its own retro thing now, I think.
There's a weird sort of, I've noticed people seem to be revisiting Scream, which I find quite odd.
Yeah,
it feels like that's become a thing that people talk about, which was in itself very kind of postmodern and self-referential. Now people are talking about it like...
Well, it's interesting because all those pre 9/11 horror films, they're kind of, it is before that momentous change, and so they kind of, there's something naive in a sense about the depiction of what horror was then, you know, and they become interesting, I think, for that reason as well, because they do, you know, it is a vanished time. And I remember seeing Vampires, Ghost of Mars in the cinema, and it was, you know, it felt like a very, very different world then. There wasn't you know,
but even at the time, certainly something like In the Mouth of Madness felt like, it did feel sort of like you were almost aware of films being 90s in the 90s.
Yes.
What, you know what I mean? Like, so that, in Mathematics, I think it was about 95.
Oh, so, but Jurassic Park. You've got like, so anything with Sam Neill as a lead is
anything
90s.
That was going to be a New Line Cinema thing that you knew would be released by Entertainment in Video. All felt like you're watching a similar kind of film.
And I've found that the really bad keyboard synthesizer sounds that in the 90s that were so weak, so non-80s, they were really bland, really awful, they now actually sound quite good, I think. I don't know what it is. It's like they actually sound quite appealing and atmospheric, but in a kind of 90s John Carpenter way. It's really odd.
Yeah. I've got 6 minutes.
Oh, wow.
We're almost 5 minutes.
Okay.
So we've got to play the game.
Got to play the game. And this game is...
Where is the...
I'll just get my thing up. It's called Better or Worse. And you just have to say whether the next person I mention is better or worse than the person before it.
Oh, my God. I'm going to fail this.
Okay. Well, not necessarily. It's all based on my own opinion. So, Ewan McGregor is your starting card. And is Christopher Reeve better or worse than... Ewan McGregor.
Christopher Reeve.
Can I just make a point? The jingle isn't too loud. Nat's too quiet.
Oh, okay.
Because you turned him down, remember? So keep going.
Christopher Reeve is better?
Better.
Correct.
Christopher Reeve is better than Ewan McGregor?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Whoopi Goldberg, better or worse than Christopher Reeve?
I'd say worse.
Worse for me.
I'm going to say worse. It is worse. Humpty Dumpty...
The fictional
nursery rhyme character, is he or she better or worse than Whoopi Goldberg?
Worse, surely. It doesn't exist.
You can't do that
to Whoopi Goldberg.
That's right. I agree.
You can't do that to Oscar-winning Whoopi Goldberg.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's a high card, certainly.
Do you know what? You can't. That's correct. that's Fan Club. Is Liam Neeson better or worse than Humpty Dumpty?
Oh, better.
Better for the same reasons, I guess.
I think you've learned something here today, haven't you?
It is a weird one, but the actual real people are better than nursery.
Real people.
You're right. Is George Cole, that's Fan Club, better or worse than Liam Neeson?
Worse?
I want to say better.
Oh!
I really like George Cole. Is Lady Gaga better or worse than George Cole?
Better. I quite like one of her songs.
But you don't like any of George Cole's songs?
I don't think I've heard many.
I don't know who George Cole is.
He's Arthur Daly.
Sure. I never watched Manda.
I'd say George Cole is better than Lady Gaga. Is Oprah Winfrey better or worse than Lady Gaga?
Oprah Winfrey better than Lady Gaga.
Better.
Better.
She gives away free cars, doesn't she?
Yeah. Harrison Ford, better or worse than Oprah Winfrey?
Better. Well, I've got to say better just because I'm a Star Wars fan from childhood.
Sure. And ZZ Top, are they better or worse than Harrison Ford?
Worse.
Worse. That's it.
I saw them live.
And what's Harrison Ford like? He did their support.
He should have closed. ZZ Top live. I saw them live and they... where was it? It was Wembley Arena, and we sat right at the far end, facing right on. Mm-hmm. It was absolutely rammed. ZZ Top came out, and they did a show, and they had like a backing screen, that was behind them that showed all of their sort of like visuals, right? And the screen, I'm not joking, was 6 foot high. it was like they turned up to do a corporate gig in a Hard Rock Cafe, right? And they just like no expense spent, right? It was just like they hadn't made any effort. It was a total cash grab. I think Thunder was supporting them, and Thunder were absolutely incredible. And then ZZ Top came out, and it was kind of like fucking hell. But anyway, you got 7 points, which ain't great, but ain't bad.
Well, okay,
it's pretty good. Once upon a time, that was a very good score.
Other sevens were Hayley Campbell, Brett mm-hmm. Goldstein, Charlie Hickson, Ian Smith, and Josh Widdicombe.
Okay.
So you're in a good
okay,
gang.
Fair enough.
Do you know what? Can you do a spreadsheet of this so that we've got that in the future? Because I think that is. Oh, you've done it!
Oh my God!
Okay, so John Niven's the only person with 10. Michael Legg got 9. Still at the bottom there, Sam Ashurst with 3. Unbelievable. But yeah, great. Well, we're going to finish now, I suppose.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much
for coming in.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Really
go
lovely.
See, go and see Possum.
Yes.
From this evening, I guess. From tonight.
And you can get it on demand as well, so you can watch it from home.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Is that the future?
I think so. Various VOD outlets.
Okay, cool.
Video on demand.
What are we going to end with? Oh, I know, sorry.
I hope it's not the whole future. I hope you can still go and see films at cinemas. I love going to the cinema.
Yeah. And because it's the best place to go to catch up with my mates and chat.
I think I've been sorry. Thank you.